reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty except for one man still.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome on the latest edition of In the Gravel Trap. I'm your host, Joey Barnes of Tribute Racing. With me is Josh Farmer, also of Tribute Racing. Adam Tate will be on with us a little later. And we've also got Christopher DeHardy of Motorsport.com. Gentlemen, y'all doing all right tonight?
Yeah, still trying to make sense of all the madness that happened in Southern California today. Other than that, I'm fine. Glad to get the show back together.
I'm doing well. Just got done cutting the backyard. Just glad everybody's okay. Ready to look forward to the next couple of races.
We've got the MAB TV 500 post-race show going on. We want to thank y'all for joining us. And, you know, we'll go ahead and do a quick rundown of the results today before we kind of take you into the aftermath. That was really an incredible and controversial race. But, you know, in MAB TV 500, we've got Graham Rahal broke a 125 race winless streak to get his second win. And he ended up beating Tony Kanaan, Marco Andretti, Juan Pablo Montoya, and rookie Sage Karam is going to round out the top five. Followed suit is Scott Dixon, James Jakes with a surprising run, finishing seventh. Charlie Kimball, Simon Pagenaud, and Jack Hawksworth collects a 10th place finish. Right behind him, we've got rookie Stefano Coletti, Carlos Munoz, Pippa Mann, Sebastian Bourdais, Ryan Briscoe, and Ryan Hunter-Reay are 15th and 16th. Both were in a both brought out the final yellow flag that ultimately ended the race under yellow. Takuma Sato and Will Power, Gabby Chavez, Joseph Newgarden, Ed Carpenter, and Elio Castroneves, who led a race high 43 laps, I believe it's 43 laps. And that's going to be your final unofficial results of the MAB TV 500. And the reason it doesn't come just plain and simple, the reason why it's very controversial is for several reasons. And first and foremost, we got Graham Rahal. And Chris, I'd like to start with you. We had the incident with Graham was he comes down the pit road. It was relatively in the middle of the race. And his fuel guy, who admitted he made a mistake, takes out the fuel gun and then reinserts it as Graham goes to leave the pit box. And ultimately, it rips the hose off of the nozzle, and Graham takes the nozzle with him, and it ends up coming off while he's on the backstretch, and it brings out a yellow flag. Many people, from what I understand, IndyCar said the penalty is coming after the race. That's still kind of sketchy to me on the situation, the exact, words as far as what was used on IndyCar's part. But a lot of people were very shocked that there wasn't a severe penalty handed out that allowed Graham to ultimately take this win.
A lot of people seem to have very short memories. First and foremost, it took me a while to make sure I got everything right regarding the accident. When I first saw it, I was thinking, Graham was an idiot for leaving, and then I saw the fuelman put the thing back in, and then my dad and I both realized, hey, this wasn't Graham's fault. That's probably why there wasn't a penalty given at the time. What I also do want to reiterate, Juan Montoya hit his air hose, ran over it at the Indy 500. He was given a post-race fine for doing that. Granted, he didn't have any pit equipment that left the box and caused an accident on track, but it has been IndyCar's MO, at least for the last few races. I'm not sure what they did in St. Petersburg, if they had any issues, is they give the penalties for pit road infractions after the race itself. Tudor had some issues with giving penalties that weren't supposed to be given, and so they look at some more things after the race instead of, possibly making bad calls during the race. And I think IndyCar might have taken a little note from that. But that's just what I've been thinking, is that it's a post-race situation, and it's just more consistency that they're not giving the penalty during the race.
But I got to look at the fact that when you look at, what NASCAR does, for instance, if we're going to talk about Tudor, which is a NASCAR-sanctioned series, you know, NASCAR, the way they handle it is if you leave your pit box with equipment, because this is a team sport, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, Jeff Gordon's fault if he leaves with the fuel can. It's the fuel man's fault for hanging it in there. But at the end of the day, you know, Graham was told to go by his right front tire changer, who that's the man that gives the order in the pit box to go or to stay. And you can say all day long it's not Graham's fault, but this is a team sport. That team left with equipment. That team should have been penalized. Ultimately, if you go by those regulations and those standards, I mean, if it's – this isn't just drivers with nobody attached to them. I mean, so I don't
really
understand.
He will be penalized, but it'll be after the race. Same thing with what happened at Montoya in Indy. Like I said, he hit his air hose. It said it'll be reviewed after the race. And I think he was given like a nominal fine of like $1,000 or something. I forget which. I don't have the email in front of me. What's more likely going to happen is Ray Hall's fuel is going to be fined either $500, $1,000, $1,500, some amount within the four-figure range, and basically told, hey, don't do it again. That's what's going to happen. It's just simple.
I don't necessarily agree with it, because at the end of the day, you can have a pass-through penalty. You can start at the tail end of the line. You can serve a one-lap penalty. You know, the guy brought out a yellow flag. Like it or not, the team messed up. And at the end of the day,
course.
I mean, at the end of the day, does Graham, I mean, this was a long overdue victory for Graham. I'm one of the surprising people that are going to say that, because I'm not the biggest Graham Rahal backer. But he ran strong today, as did a lot of people. But at the end of the day, I got to think that there's got to be something there in the race, because what happened is his issue with having that fuel nozzle come out affected the race. So, but, you know, that said, Josh, what's your take on this whole situation?
Well, I agree with you that there should have been a penalty during the race. I mean, this whole, you know, penalizing people after the race is essentially just a slap on the wrist. I mean, you know, I think, but then again, I think a lot of the perception, I mean, obviously Twitter is going mad about this race, which actually love it or hate it, people are talking about IndyCar, which I guess that's a good thing in of itself. But, you know, I mean, but, you know, if there would have been the penalty during, excuse me, if there would have been a penalty during the race, I think a lot of the bitching by all of us probably would subside, you know. But yeah, it's just it doesn't seem to make sense to me. I mean, sure, it didn't interfere with the on track with the racing on track, except if my memory serves me correctly, Chris probably remembers this better than I do, since he's a walking, talking stat machine. But in 2006 at the Indy 500, didn't Fornish pull? Didn't he pull out of his pits with the Buckeye still in, and he ended up knocking down a few crew guys, and then he was penalized, and then eventually strategized his way back to win the race.
He did. The thing that I do want to remember is that back in 2006 there was a different penalty protocol than there was in 2015.
Sure.
Back then it was just one steward. It was Brian Barnhart, and he makes a decision. Now it's a panel of three, which Barnhart is one of the three.
Well,
yeah.
To Josh's point, you had mentioned that they're talking about it on Twitter, and yes, Twitter has blown up tremendously. And when is the last time a race outside of the Indy 500 got 12.4 thousand tweets about a particular race? Because currently the hashtag MavTV500 is, I mean, it's trending. I mean, it's 12.4 thousand tweets just about that. And, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of social media per se, because I'm more old school, but at the end of the day, it's what drives a lot of things nowadays. And love it or leave it, it's right now, I don't remember the last time anything outside of the Indy 500 was really this talked about, outside of tragic circumstances a number of years ago. And that's one of the reasons why it is trending, is because a lot of people think that what we saw today was pack racing. A lot of drivers were very critical. Many fans loved it, but also some hated it. I mean, this right here is the biggest reason why it's trending, is because of the product that we saw today. New aero kits and everything else that's kind of come to play here at Fontana. And at the end of the day, Honda was actually relevant, had a fighting chance. You know, obviously they stuck one in victory lane, and it wasn't, believe it or not, to me, it wasn't the guy that I thought was going to be a contender. I actually thought that Marco Andretti was unarguably to me, Marco Andretti was by far and away the best Honda. And had it not been for a very questionable block going into turn three on the second to last lap heading to the white flag, or that caution coming out, literally crossing the start-finish line on the white flag, I think Marco with fresh tires had it to get it done to collect his third career victory. But and that one as well, like Graham Rahal, long overdue. But, you know, looking at the product that we've got, I just think today was – pack racing is what Vegas was. It's what Texas was 10 years ago. It is wall-to-wall, four wide, Daytona and Talladega on a mile-and-a-half type stuff. And what this more or less reminded me of was the 2000 year with CART at Michigan, where you got to still play with the throttle a little bit going in the corners. You've got to pick your lines and stay off the weepers, which is the name of the game today. And ultimately, you're making your moves on the straightaway and just positioning yourself in the corner. And, you know, Chris, I'll start with you to get your take on this is, you know, what are your opinions about the racing we saw today? And I know, I imagine this is going to get pretty heated, but, you know, what's your opinion of the racing we saw today? Do you agree that this was pack racing? Was it just a good small de-evolution of pack racing? Was it just tight racing? And ironically, you know, this is the first time that we've had anything resembling pack racing since Brian Barnhart had been back in control at Vegas in 2013. So what are your thoughts here?
The only thing more exciting than what was taking place on track was learning what the hell Steve Match was going to yell out next. First of all, he was fantastic in the booth. I hope he's in Iowa. But I digress. What we saw today was partial pack racing at best. There was still space for the cars to spread out a little bit, where if you're at Vegas, there was no room with the formula that they had for there to be any kind of separation with the cars. See, in the first segment of the race where they had like 130-something laps of green flag racing, after the first like 15 or 20 laps, you could see some separation a little bit. Not very much, but still, it was enough where it wasn't fully, you know, Chicagoland 2009. I still remember that race where it was 3x3x3x3 with Servia and Rahal near the front of that pack. That was ridiculous. Go check it out on YouTube if you haven't, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends. It was very, very exciting from my seat. I was watching, you know, Twitter, of course, seeing a couple of people in the media, watching from their hotel rooms, getting all excited and jazzed up about it. It was fun to see. But, of course, we must remember at the end of the day, there has to be a balance between what fans want and what the drivers want. The drivers want situations like Texas. Fans kind of want something like Fontana. There has to be an even balance between the two where both parties can be happy. And, of course, we also must remember, motor racing is inherently dangerous. It always has been. It always will be. There will always be risks to it, but we need to, of course, try to minimize these risks as much as possible without, you know, stopping the ultimate course of action here, which is going for the win as hard as you can. Josh, what's up?
Well, I mean, today's race was definitely different than what we've been seeing at Fontana. I would agree that I would say it was kind of a de-evolution of pack racing, and, you know, for the first 130 laps or so until Elio Castroneves crashed, but whatever, you know, I mean, from the start, I got to tell you, I was sweating bullets because I was like, shit, we don't want this pack racing again. Look what happened in 2011. You know, I mean, the difference I can see there is that Fontana is a track designed for IndyCar racing. It's relatively low banked, you know, 11 or 14 degrees. I can't remember which, but, and it's wider than Vegas. And so, you know, even if there was pack racing, there's definitely more room to do it than there was at Vegas or Chicago or TMS or what have you. But, you know, I mean, so that being said, there's room to race. But still, you know, I'm gonna agree with a few of the drivers that, you know, it's just when you can't get away from everybody, you know it can get a little hairy at times. And I mean, I would say I'm not gonna blame 100% everything on pack racing, but the wreck at the end you know, with Ryan Briscoe and Ryan Hunter-Reay was, a couple guys got loose and pinballed off each other, and you know, and they were running 3x3x3 going for the win at coming to get the white flag, which that was kind of brought on by bringing out the red flag and getting IndyCar's version of a green white checkered. But that's another topic. Maybe we'll touch on it later. But it was definitely different. But it was but the whole thing was kind of caused by IndyCar added downforce in order to compensate for the higher temperatures of running this race in the day, which I don't know why they didn't have this race at night. You know, I mean, they moved it to the summer because Fontana wanted to get off Labor Day, because last year the crowd wasn't that great. But as we saw, moving it to the summer, the crowd was even worse. And I'm not entirely sure why the race was not moved to a night race. I'd have to talk to people at IndyCar and Fontana for that. So, but then at the end of the day, talking about the winner, we've already hit on Graham Rahal's penalty, but Rahal has been a lot stronger all year, and it was good to see a Honda running competitive up there too, and win for them in their backyard.
Well, as far as the times you talked about the race being at night, there have been so many people that have been so critical about media and fans alike about the fact that the season finale had started at like 8 o'clock at night or 9 o'clock at night, and it would end at 1 a.m. on Eastern time, even though it's only like, 10 o'clock on the West Coast at that point. And so as far as why the race started when it started, I got to think that this is simply a tryout, and maybe IndyCar is just trying to get the whole process right, because let's make no mistake, they cleaned a lot of house over the last few years and are really trying to get it right. And at the end of the day, there's a lot of things that IndyCar needs to do, but sometimes I wish the fans would just stop bitching, shut up, and just enjoy what we got, because at the end of the day, what we saw today was a solid race. And you know what, I saw 5 cars wreck really bad in Indianapolis. They weren't in a pack. I saw 4 of them flip. They were by themselves. At the end of the day, this happens. It's racing. And as much as, I love hearing Will Power, because, that right there is popcorn material every time. And, what are we doing? What are we doing? We talked about it, and Tim Cindric saying we talked about this after 2013, and here we are. I got to think that Brian Barnhart might be the unluckiest guy in the world, being around the first chance they get with the aero packages. He might just be the most unluckiest guy I think I've ever met when it comes to IndyCar. But at the same time, Marco Andretti saying things like, look, it was fun, cars going forward, cars going backwards, this kind of racing is dangerous, but we're race car drivers, this is what we sign up for. And, the comments from Bourdais and Indy, Marco's comments today, you're a race car driver. I mean, it is what you sign up for. If you don't want to go out there and race cars, and I understand when things get too hairy and too crazy, and, things like Kanaan said, I want somebody to come out here and try it. Marco Andretti's trying it, Sebastian Bourdais trying it, and they don't have a problem with it. And, not everybody is going to agree on a package. If everybody agreed on a package, I mean, hell would freeze over, because at the end of the day, the guy that's running, 30th or in NASCAR wants more downforce or less downforce because he knows he can wing it around better. But the guy that's winning all the time because the package fits his driving style, he doesn't want that to change, and he's going to bitch and moan about it. And so I just wish for once people would shut up, be happy with what we saw today, because it was – controversial, yes. We had a ton of lead changes. There was over 70 lead changes. We set a new IndyCar record 80. For lead changes. And, yes, we saw a car get airborne on the last lap. That was unfortunate. That's what happens on essentially green-white checkers. NASCAR does it all the time. If they had open cockpits, it'd be scarier for them too. But at the end of the day, these are IndyCar drivers. They're the best at what they do in these cars. And I just... it was a hell of a race. I literally put everything down. The world stopped for about 3.5 hours for me. because that race was so captivating. And I don't even remember the last time that that happened where I could just stop everything I was doing because a race just grabbed me that much.
One thing I do want to bring up, despite, you know, all the stuff that we saw earlier today, the caution that happened with Elio Castroneves, I think we should go on a little bit. That caution lasted way too long. Did anyone find out like what they were doing? Like, were they just sweeping the track, or what was going on there?
As far as I know, they were trying to get the car fired.
They were just trying to get the what?
They were trying to get Elio's car fired because Roger was in Elio's ear on the radio saying, you know, tell him to fire it up and you'll bring it back. And there was, you know, whether he was too close to the wall, they couldn't pull it forward. I don't know what the deal was, but he stayed stuck there for a number of laps. And then finally he just had to take it to the back. You know, maybe there was a drivetrain issue because it was a pretty wild spin and he backed it into the fence. So maybe there was some sort of gearing issue there where at first they thought they could fire it up and then eventually they just had to get it towed back. I don't really know. But yeah, to your point, I mean, 14 laps for a single car spin under yellow is ridiculous. You know, I don't even agree with the fact that after the Will Power Takuma Sato crash, I don't understand why we ran four laps under yellow and then decided to throw the red flag. You know there's nine laps to go. You know it's going to take you a minute to clean up.
Throw it immediately.
What?
Throw it immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't understand what the hell they're thinking on that one. But, you know, I mean, let's not make – IndyCar's learning. And, I mean, they've got new people in there. Some people that don't have a lick of racing experience. Some people that are just business people. And some people that are racers, and collectively they just got to learn together because the racing people got to learn the business people got to learn the racing, and it's a tall task. And this season's been an absolute nightmare for IndyCar. I mean, look at Brazil, the race canceled. You start your season off way on the wrong foot when you have the opening race, an international race that was going to pay you a very nice sanctioning fee, cancel on you. You've got NOLA, which, Chris, I know you love it down there, but that race, number one, sucked, and they never should have put that race on at that time of year. And they shouldn't have even gone ahead with it. They should have just waited it out or done it on an off week. You're going to run, you know, a myriad of races in a short amount of time this summer, and you're going to end on Labor Day again or the week before Labor Day with Sonoma, which, say what you will, road course, oval, I personally like seeing races finished on an oval for a championship. I feel like it's more of a fair fight, but, you know, it's only fair.
Unless you're Ed Carpenter.
Yeah, well, Ed Carpenter just – don't even get me started. But
his team has been such a yo-yo this year. At Texas, you know, they had both cars in the doldrums. They both go out within two laps of each other. Then at Toronto, they both get a 1-2, and now they both take each other out. They break rule number one of racing. You don't take out your teammate.
Well, it looked like his nose just kind of washed up coming out of the pool. I mean, so, and there's nothing you could do at 210 miles an hour. If your nose washes up, you don't have any front grip to really steer it back left. So, you know.
I'm not even sure if he was off the throttle at that point, honestly. I mean, hell, the same thing happened to me in a race in iRacing yesterday at Fontana. I was on place for a second place finish. My nose washed up following another car, hit the turn four wall. The next stop, I spin it around, and I'm out, even no matter how much I backed off. But I didn't hear his onboard throttle trace. Did he back off that much before he hit Newgarden or no?
It sounded like he backed off.
I don't know. I didn't have the telemetry app on my iPhone running, so I don't know. I mean, only Ed knows what happened. I mean, at least they were in good spirits about it.
Do you believe, Josh? Do you believe that this product that we saw today is essentially really close to the perfect combination, or do you think it is the perfect combination to what IndyCar has been seeking on a bigger track like this?
Well, as I said earlier, it was a de-evolution of pack racing, and I am not a fan of pack racing. I mean, I was a fan of, you know, sure, the Hanford device back in the day. You know, I know Zanardi hated it because everyone was passing each other, but if you watch the Hanford device. They weren't running three and four wide lap after lap where nobody can move the Hanford device. You picked up, you would pick up a ton of speed and then zip by. But I mean, my take has been is that, you know, I mean, obviously the IndyCar is still learning with the aero kits. True. I mean, the aero kits are producing a lot more downforce this year, you know, and as I said earlier, you know, the extra downforce they had and that they mandated was set forth to compensate for the higher temperatures because they moved the race to the summer, which had the race not been moved to the summer, we likely would have seen a much different race had the race been held on, you know, in Saturday in September or October or August. Where was I going with this? But I think an ideal package would just be, obviously you want to have some kind of box because you don't want people going completely willy nilly and crazy. But I think, you know, let the teams run what they want to run. You know, kind of like what we sort of had in mind at Indy of, you know, in practice teams were experimenting with the different packages, and of course, you know, everybody freaked out when the Chevy started flipping, but, you know, I mean, the three accidents that flipped at Indy, I don't need to kick this dead horse anymore, but all three accidents were different, and I don't think the aero kits were, other than the bumpers on the rear, but they fixed that by putting the enclosure panels on. So, but I think it's just an ideal package would just be let the teams figure it out for themselves. And I think, you know, making the cars harder to drive. I mean, I covered the last three races at Fontana from 2012 to 2014. You know, I'm very sad I didn't get to make it this year, but you know, I mean, the package in 2012 was nearly perfect. I mean, it was an exciting, you know, I thought it was an exciting race. And 2013 was a drama with only nine cars finishing, and 2014 was rather lackluster. So it's just, I mean, I think the ideal package, I want to say one more time only, just, you know, let teams figure out what they want to run. If they want to run a setup so a driver can run flat out all the way around for 500 miles, you know, let them. If teams want to take the downforce out, let them.
Right, Chris, right before we get to your point, I just want to read out a quote from current points leader Juan Pablo Montoya after today's finish. He finished fourth today. He said, and I quote, "Honestly, I was not a fan of the racing we put on today. What I told IndyCar yesterday was that we shouldn't be racing like this. This is a full-packed racing, and sooner or later somebody is going to get hurt. We don't need to be doing this. It was a hell of a show, and we did what we needed to do. We had a good PPG Chevy. When Will crashed and Elio crashed, for me, the only goal was to finish ahead of Scott or ahead of Dixon, and we did that. So it's all good, and everybody did a great job again today." You know, I mean, there's just – that's your Indy 500 champion. This guy has been a part of pack racing at Daytona and Talladega, and I mean, with NASCAR, and I got to think that this pack racing is a hell of a lot different than that. But before, you know, Chris, to follow Josh's thoughts on your thoughts on the racing, if you think it's too far off of what IndyCar is looking for, and also your thoughts about Juan's quote.
Honestly, it just needs to be tweaked a little bit. If they had a little bit more separation, I'd say it'd be damn near perfect. Do what?
I was agreeing with you. I said, oh, well stated.
Oh, sorry. It was just a small amount of more separation, and you'd have it absolutely perfect. Then again, we also have to remember, Indianapolis is kind of a joker card when it comes to testing out what you can do with aero kits. And Texas, it's not really as a true flat-out test like how Fontana is, because Fontana was actually built specifically for IndyCar racing, kind of.
Yep.
Or at least I think it was.
Yeah, it was.
Hell. Okay, just making sure, because, I mean, you know, everybody says, you know, this place is built for that, that place is built for that, you know. I mean, hell, Barber's built for motorcycles, like, and IndyCar puts on great races there. That being said, Fontana was the first real big wide-open test for oval racing with aero kits like that. And with a little less downforce and a little more power, we'd see a little more separation. And frankly, I think that's what everybody wants to see. Of course, the person who I'd really would like to see, hear his opinion on, honestly, isn't so much Juan, but I would love to hear what Stefano Coletti had to say about this, because this was his first time at Fontana. This was his first major oval race where he had to deal with cars, you know, that close to each other. And frankly, he would be an interesting person to talk to. I mean, Juan's had to deal with this kind of stuff back in the kart days at Fontana. Granted, his opinion is important, but then again, there's 20 other drivers out there who race as well, and they know the situation too. That being said, let's see what the next time they the next big race, the oval, they go. Let's see what Pocono brings us, really.
I actually have Stefano Coletti. Says nothing really about pack racing. He just talks about being happy with the result today and how it took a while for him to get comfortable in the car. And, you know, he went down a couple of laps at the beginning, but thanks to the yellows, was able to get back and blah, blah, blah. I'm happy with my best oval finish. So, Will Power. The Verizon Chevy team did a great job today, despite how tough of a day it was. When you have a packed race like we had today, you have to take a lot of risk to gain track position. As exciting as it is, it's intense at the same time. I'm just glad that no one got hurt out there and that everybody is okay. Now we move on to Milwaukee, which I'm really looking forward to after how well we ran there in our win last year. Man, you know, let me ask y'all this. You know, for me personally, I think that today was maybe something that was kind of a turning point in the entire sport, not just because it was a slight de-evolution of pack racing and we may have found a product that was a little bit more fine-tuned. I'll tell you this, if we have more tire wear, just a little, like if they brought the same right front that they had at Texas over here, because that was the only combination of tire that was different. They ran all three tires, left front, left rear, right rear, that they ran at Texas Motor Speedway. They run the same tire combination. It produces a little bit more tire wear towards the end of a run. You could have that separation, but have pack racing or tight racing at the beginning. They came with a different right front, and, I mean, it was a hell of a lot of close three and four wide battles at 1.5 wide. But
Speaking of tires, sorry, Joey, I did want to bring this up. We also cannot forget that there were several drivers that pitted with three or four laps to go to put on new tires. One of them, especially Marco, could have easily have won this race if Briscoe and Hunter Ray and Montoya didn't tap each other right before the white flag came out. Just to show how much the tire situation changed with the course of, you know, just a few laps like that, that could have been a major turning point. We could have been talking about something totally different had Marco Andretti won this race off of a late race tire stop with four laps to go.
Well, where I was going with this was how this race was essentially a turning point of potentially IndyCar as a whole. And just when I'm looking at the whole picture of this race, I look at the lead changes. There was 15 or 14 different drivers that led today out of the 23 that were on there. You know, Elio, super strong. Tony Kanaan was a stud. And, you know, Marco was absolutely blazing, just like Takuma Osato was. Roughly, probably the fifth best car won today, which is a little unfortunate to say, maybe even the tenth best car. But at the end of the day, I believe this is the first time ever, and I'd have to go back through the record books to really look through it, that a name like Graham Rahal and Marco Andretti both sat on the podium. And this has been something that this sport has needed. Is those guys are 26 and 28, if I remember correctly. Graham's 26, Marco's 28, respectively. And they're still young. You know, Michael Andretti didn't win his first championship until he was 29. So I look at the whole grand scheme of things, and I got to think that this is what this sport needed. These kids are starting to really coming to their own as far as race car drivers go. Graham's had several great runs. He's been the best Honda driver all year. Marco's starting to creep into that conversation with solid runs, but with this win, Graham has really solidified that. And, you know, if we can see a manufacturer, an OEM in Honda that can get on a level playing field with Chevy, like we saw today, I think that these kids got a really good chance at grabbing this sport by storm, because finally, something that we've been waiting for almost 10 years now, or actually with Marco, exactly 10 years. So I look at this, eventually the Elios, the Simon Pagenaud, the Will Powers, the Scott Dixons, they're slowly going to ride off into the sunset, and these kids are going to be in their mid-30s and trying to whoop all the young kids' ass in the sport. And, you know, I look at somebody like Sage Karam, which that everybody is all over this kid, and oh, what a great run, and oh, he drove so well today, and there are several times I saw him slide on the weepers and lose his car when he got under somebody or almost pretty much dive bomb. To me, that's not smart racing. He doesn't know how to stay behind his teammate. I am ripping the kid. Hopefully he learns from a lot of this, because I think that if he could have just been slightly patient for a half a lap and made a move in a different place, he would have been easily a contender for the win there at the end. Just by putting himself in a little bit better position and being slightly more patient, and maybe that's the learning curve. He finished fifth. He led his first career laps. He led five laps today. But, I mean, at the end of the day, that kid, the wreck was a combination of Montoya sliding up into Hunter Ray, who Sage was right above Hunter Ray. Both were behind Marco, Graham, and Tony Kanaan. And then that's how the wreck starts on the front stretch. So, I mean, if he's not in the middle of the track, if he's running the high lane and three wide and whatnot, I just, for the life of me, I don't understand why Sage Karam just couldn't ease up a little bit more. I mean, everybody talks and raves about his talent. You know, talent's only going to take you so far if you don't get your head out of your ass. That said, awkward silence. Chris, do you have any...
Sorry. No, go ahead, Josh.
Oh no. He was talking to you.
Okay, sorry about that. It's very, very difficult to try and get a proper balance on this. I don't think IndyCar did any testing. I want to reiterate that I don't think IndyCar did any testing at Fontana before, you know, the first practice session. So I mean, huge race simulation type testing there. So they didn't really know what's going to take place. I tell you what, it's one thing that I think we need to bring up also is promotion. There might have been 5,000 to 10,000 people in those stands out there. That was absolutely pitiful. Joey, do you have a partial solution to this?
Well, don't run the race the same weekend NASCAR's in Sonoma, and then have fans choose whether or not to go to Wine Country or go to Fontana. I mean, they may be several hours apart, but, I mean, at the end of the day, you're running – this is the other thing I don't understand is NASCAR had their schedule out pretty far in advance before the end of last year. IndyCar waited and waited and waited, and honestly, they probably waited because they didn't have the whole thing put together. And I'm looking at this, and I got to think that it's a matter of having in comparison, the product is great, but in comparison to what they can bring marketability-wise and the amount of fans that are going to show up, I think having it's a $2 million sanctioning fee is a little high, and I think the asking price, you know, if they came down to 1.7, you lose $300,000, yes, but imagine the amount of races you could add. Like, if you could add an extra race weekend in there, are you really losing money if collectively you made the overall amount back? You put on something there, the fans can do something more. I'm just now starting to see IndyCar commercials actually on TV and drivers being actually relevant. And that's been a long time coming. I don't remember, outside of Elio and Dancing with the Stars, where's Will Power in Verizon commercials? You know, where's Scott Dixon in Target? I went into Target one time and I saw an itty-bitty banner that was like 2 inches tall while I was going to pick up, razors. I don't understand it for the life of me. You know, Target is a huge brand. Do something with Scott Dixon. Verizon's a huge brand. Do something with Will. You know, Dr. Pepper. Do something with Marco. Steak and Shake has done something with Graham and Steak and Shake. I mean, hell, Graham is pretty much racing for his career because after this year, he's having to look for a sponsorship, and he doesn't even know if he's going to be back in his own father's car. So, I mean, for a put-up-or-shut-up moment, Graham's making it happen, and he's doing it honestly as being one of the lowest-funded teams out there in comparison to the Andretti Autosports, the Ganassis, the Penske's, and I just wish, I just wish that they would figure it out, because obviously Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanigan Racing has figured it out.
Yeah, I have a couple notes on the schedule. I saw Michael Knight actually tweet, which those of you that don't know Michael Knight's an industry insider. He's been a PR guy for many guys in the kart days, but he actually spoke to Mark Miles today, and he gave out little snippets. He'll probably have an article posted up on his blog, but he actually said that whether or not the season is going to end on Labor Day is actually still up in the air for next year. He said depends on when we start, and he said if the season starts in late March like it has the last couple of years with St. Petersburg, which I know there's maybe some international races coming back, and there's also a slight chance Homestead might be back. Keep your eye on that one. But, you know, he said if the season starts in late March, if they can't get anything to fill in the front space, he said it might not end on Labor Day next year. So, I mean, that would be awesome for Fontana. They can move it back to the season finale. Or, you know, another possible date for Fontana is, you know, they could open the season in February in Southern California at Fontana. You know, I mean, the weather is always warm there, and, you know, California's been in a drought for the last 3 years, so we don't have to worry about rain. So, you know, there's some options there, but, I mean, still, it's just having as low of a crowd as there was, I mean, it makes IndyCar look like a loser to the public. I mean, I'm glad this race, the one thing this race has that a few of the other oval races don't have, like Pocono didn't have until this year, is Fontana's got a solid title sponsor in MAV-TV. I mean, MAV-TV in of itself is a growing network for us gearheads, but, you know, but I mean, they're paying the bills, and they're sponsoring the race, and that accounts for something. And they've got one more year left on their agreement, but I don't know if after this low crowd, despite the on track product, I don't know if they're going to want to. And I don't know if they're going to want to take the option to even come back for next year. I mean, Shell and Pennzoil pulled the plug on Houston.
Well, I at the end of the day, I think why not start the season in California? I mean, St. Pete's a nice venue and everything, but I'm okay with starting out west and working your way east. Right now, the damn schedule makes no sense because, you know, you're going from NOLA to Fontana to Barber. You know, it's like, why not just run Barber, NOLA, St. Pete all together and then go out west to run Sonoma and Fontana and maybe hopefully eventually Phoenix, come to Texas. You know, let's string some stuff together. Number one, because these truck drivers log a lot of hours. Number two, the budget. This isn't the kart days where I believe it was in the Robin Miller column about a week or so ago. He talked to a mechanic that wasn't named, but the mechanic said, you know, back in kart, we win the race or we win a championship, you make $34,000 as a bonus money. You know, and the schedule was nice and everything was easy. The money was good. If you win the championship now, you're lucky if you make $3,400. And you're logging longer hours, and some of them haven't seen their home in over 20 days or 21 days. And it's like, I understand you signed up for this because this is the passion of a sport and you love it. And it's kind of like being a driver. This is what you signed up for, that regardless, you're going to run the race. Damn the package or anything else that comes into play. You're a race car driver. If you don't want to race, step out of the car. Somebody will gladly fill your spot. And, you know, I mean, ultimately it's the same thing when it comes to that. But, I mean, when it comes to just being smart with cost, I don't see how running from one end of the country to the other is smart on cost. So, I guess long story short, because this is the post-race show, I would love to see Fontana run in February. I think that's smart. It might conflict with NASCAR because NASCAR runs to Fontana right after Daytona. NASCAR has the money to do that. But, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing it before Indy. Personally, I think that Fontana should be saved for the end of the year in October, late September, and that they should be running Milwaukee in April leading into Indy. You know, let's try to run up north as much as we can during the summer. And then let's come down south for, unless it's at night, but let's come down south in the fall and in early spring.
One thing that I think you might find interesting, so Robin Miller recently released a video message to Mark Miles talking about the schedule, and you mentioned, you know, whether they'll even be back at Fontana. The Fontana track owner, when Robin Miller asked him that, will they be back, and he said, I'll have IndyCar back if I can get it in September as a season finale. Frankly, I think the Fontana track owner is pissed at having the worst date on the schedule. Sunday, it's Saturday afternoon race at 1:30 when it's 90-something degrees out there. On the same weekend, NASCAR is, you know, 400 miles up the road in Sonoma, making, you know, everybody choose between going to see NASCAR or going to see the IndyCars. Frankly, and he also has some, you mentioned Penske and Ganassi and all. He basically told Team Miller that they have to band together and basically tell Mark Miles to, you know, shut up and stop listening to the Boston Consulting Group because, frankly, he basically said that ending the schedule on Labor Day weekend was one of the worst ideas in motorsport. Frankly, I agree with him. There's no excuse for it. You're not the don't worry about football. Just worry about putting on a good show and people will watch. But at the end of the day, I can't. It's not my place to actually do anything about the schedule. That's not my pay grade, unfortunately. Josh, did you have anything on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's where, like what you said, what Dave Allen told Robin Miller was, you know, I want it back as the season finale. I mean, that race, or I should say, this race had date equity in there being a season finale, and you know, I mean, it was a hell of a season finale in the kart days. I mean, it's like it's like I go looking through archive pictures and looking from 1999 through, or 1997 through 1999, and the kart race was filled wall to wall, you know, and then when the IRL started running there, the IRL crowd sucked, and then kart went belly up in 2003, and the race was never held, you know, but that's where, I mean, the topic of date equity is one thing that, one could be the devil's advocate for running all these IndyCar races jam-packed together and say, well, NASCAR does it. Well, NASCAR has the money. It's the biggest motorsport in the Americas, love them or hate them. And, you know, and they have date equity. You know, Sonoma is the same race weekend every year. Daytona is always the 4th of July. New Hampshire is always right after Daytona. You know, Bristol is always in the spring. And, you know, IndyCar's got a little bit of that with, you know, Long Beach is always in April. You know, and then of course you've got the Indy 500, but you know, the last few years they just keep, you know, they keep shuffling all the races around, and obviously we saw how bad it hurt Houston last year, moving it to, ironically, was this weekend last year is when Houston got moved from October, but they had to move Houston because having it during football season caused problems with the track, you know. But you know, it's essentially it's just, you know, if IndyCar keeps pissing track owners off and they're biting the hand that feeds them, you know. The series is not going to go anywhere, you know. I mean, I don't think Miles is the worst CEO, but he's kind of taking the advice of the Boston Consulting Group more than anything else. But I mean, I think Miles is, it seems like a semi-decent. He's not the worst IndyCar CEO by any means.
Well, I mean, it just goes to the point of what I was talking about earlier, where you've got guys who you know, you've got businessmen who are trying to learn the racing, and you've got racing people who are trying to learn the business. And it's just a blend. And I don't disagree with the blend that's being held and is taking place. But at the same time, I don't disagree either with your point on date equity. I think at the end of the day, you've also got to think that TV ultimately is ruling all. I mean, TV is even telling NASCAR, these are the date, this is the time of the race, this is this, and it's going to be at this time. We can only do this track. I mean, let's not forget that it was the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and IndyCar trying to put together the Grand Prix of Indianapolis for the final race of the season. And ultimately, TV said, hell no, that's not going to happen. You better find a new damn date. And they pushed it all the way to the beginning of May because that's the only thing that they really had feasible and available. Did it work out a little bit? Yes. Is that now something you have with date equity? Probably. But at the end of the day, too much power is being given to the media and to TV to dictate and throw the racing series around. At the end of the day, the racing series themselves need to stand up, work together with the tracks and say, we're coming to you on this date. And ultimately, you look at the people on TV and say, we're going here. You can come along or you just don't have to. At the end of the day, they're still going to want to showcase your product because they know that your product brings money and they know that your product brings a hell of a lot of money. So I think that through the years, we've really moved away from, you know, going from the 70s, the 80s, even the 90s when it was the series that would show up at the track and do what needed to be done and the TV following them. We've run into a situation now where just TV holds too much power. And I really hate that because ultimately it's killing the sport. It's to a point, it's really hurt NASCAR. And unfortunately for IndyCar, it's really suffered. But to try to get back on point with the post-race and what's gone on today, how do you feel as far as Chris? You know, we've got Graham, we've got Marco. How do you feel ultimately about how this has played out with these two young kids finally starting to show their talent and maybe potentially being able to lead this series? Do you think they're ready for that, or do you think it's something that's not going to happen just yet?
Long overdue. Oh, my God. Long overdue. This was, if Marco would have won, it would have been his first win since Iowa 2011. Ray Hall, this is his first win in 125 starts since St. Petersburg 2008. They both should have been driving like this back in 2009, 2010. Well, for Marco's case, 2007, 2008. I mean, granted, Marco's had good finishes, you know, through the years, but where was the consistency? There wasn't really one. They both should have been like this a long time ago, and I like the fact that they're showing it, but like I said, it should have been there years ago. It shouldn't have taken this long, IMO. Then again, there are extenuating circumstances, but some racers find their way around it, some don't. It just depends on a few different factors that you can't really control.
Josh, how about you?
Josh?
Yeah, I think Marco is, or not Marco, I'm sorry. Graham is finally getting it together this year. I mean, I think, you know, one of the reasons, I mean, that people have hit on that I agree with is that Bobby's not calling the shots on in his radio anymore. And, you know, I think anybody can attest to it if your parents are constantly on your butt all day. You know, it's going to impede with you trying to function. But, you know, I mean, Graham, You know, he has some consistency at Newman Haas, but he just wasn't a winner per se. And you know, Marco's been kind of strange that, you know, he had a couple off years where he was just god awful, and then, a few years ago he was leading the points without winning a race, and he was finishing in the top five every week, but he just hadn't won, and he's still top five in points. But now, you know, Marco, clearly the best Andretti Autosport driver out there right now, Marco and Carlos. And, you know, then again, it kind of brings me back to the point of, you know, IndyCar drivers tend to peak as they get older, you know, with the only exception being Scott Dixon, who's been who's been really good since he started for racing IndyCar when he was 20 years old in 2001. So, I mean, I think given time, Marco and Graham are going to get there. But will it move the needle in the sport? That's difficult to say because for a couple of reasons. So number one, inherently, they're, you know, I hate to use this term because it's not their fault, but they're trust fund kids. They're driving what they want in the family garage. You know, I iterate that again. You know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. That's not necessarily their fault, but that's the way the public sees them. And, you know, and it's like, you know, will we get the same fans that cheered on Bobby and the same fans that cheered on Michael? Well, I mean, it seems like wherever I go, there's two sides to this. Is that number one, a lot of the fans of kart during the era when Bobby and Michael raced have left over a result of the split and many years that have trickled down since that. But the other end of it is that I mean, Andretti still has a huge fan following. I mean, you know, I mean, if you look at the first race back at Pocono after Marco won the pole, easily 10,000 people, an extra 10,000 people showed up at Pocono, where Ray Hall has never really had that strong, rounded fan base. I wouldn't say not as strong as Andretti.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome Mr. Adam Tate to the show. Adam, how are you doing this evening?
I am doing wonderful. Good to be joining you guys to talk about a race that I think us and a lot of other people in the IndyCar community are going to be talking about for a very, very long time to come.
I want to speed you up to date here. First off, as much as people want to call it pack racing, tight racing, or just a de-evolution of pack racing, whatever you're, and I know you and I are about to disagree a holy hell of a lot on this, but
we'll see. Keep going.
But at the end of the day, it's being talked about. There's over 12,400 tweets. I don't remember the last race outside of an Indy 500 that has produced that much conversation without something tragically happening. So the people are talking about it. It's about damn time somebody's talking about it. And
amen to that.
And at the end of the day, do you believe that this is a is this more of what IndyCar was looking for, or do you feel like this is pack racing? I don't see the Chicago, Vegas, TMS resemblance from several seasons ago.
No, and it's not pack racing in that traditional sense. What it is it's a lot, hell of a lot better. They're showing a lot more driver skill. The risk factor is there. We saw Briscoe. We saw the Briscoes okay. We saw the other crashes throughout the day. So I don't think it is as dangerous as some of the heated passions were right after the race. The most poignant, the most passionate to me is when they were talking to Will Power and Power referenced Las Vegas 2011 and, you know, it'll happen again. And things like that do from time to time happen in racing. It's almost inevitable. But this is something totally different. We saw IndyCars going five wide. You don't see anything go five wide. You wouldn't see Formula 2000 cars going five wide. And hearing these guys going five wide at 210, 215, it was absolutely fantastic to watch. I can definitely understand if you've been in that car for those couple hours that your nerves are probably just shot to hell. But it was good. I'm curious to see if it's something that plays out at the other ovals. We didn't quite have racing like this at TMS. It wasn't this frantic at Indy. 80 lead changes. Is this something that is a super speedway phenomenon with this aero package they're going with? Or will we see this when we go to Milwaukee and when we go to Iowa? What do you guys think?
I personally, you know, as far as this package goes or what have you, I mean, I don't think we're going to see anything close to the same show at Milwaukee or Iowa. I think that given the fact that it's just a shorter, smaller track, it's, you know, for Milwaukee, it's a hell of a lot flatter. So, I mean, at the end of the day, it's also a road course package that gets taken there, road course / short track package. So to answer your question on, you know, I just don't see it. Chris?
Well, I have to go back to what I said earlier. We had a near-perfect balance, just a little bit more spacing out, and it would have been the absolute best, in my opinion. I have nothing else to say other than that, honestly.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and I'll wrap this up. But it's just as I said earlier, the, you know, the extra downforce added for this race in order to compensate for the higher temperatures was kind of what was what led to. But I'm just in favor of letting the teams run what they want. I mean, obviously we don't want an extreme amount of downforce. I mean, ultimately at the end of the day, the better package will be more power, less downforce.
What is the biggest thing you took away from this race, Adam? I mean, Will Power was pretty upset there post-race. We heard what he had to say about it. We heard Tim Cindric. Marco seems to be in favor of this, as does Ed Carpenter. Marco essentially saying that, I mean, cars go forward, backwards. You know, you're a race car driver. This is dangerous, but this is what you signed up for.
Exactly. I find some of the split reactions really interesting. You got guys like Marco and AJ Foyt praising it. You've got Ed Carpenter praising it, even though he and Newgarden took each other out the same incident. And then you get guys who ran well, like Power, who you almost got taken out, the close call with Castroneves and Briscoe. I love that you could see a guy push forward. He could fall back from, you know, the pit stops, or he could just fall back, and he could drive right back to the front. And you saw Ray Hall doing that all day. You saw Andretti doing it. You saw Kanaan doing it. You saw everybody do it. I mean, Hunter Ray finally led laps. I'm sure he was loving it until that horrible crash there at the end. So that was great to see. That they need to replicate. You know, there were some dicey moments, but they got through this one. The biggest thing I take away from it is the exposure it's getting IndyCar. Honestly, the fact that this is a super speedway, and super speedways are something that IndyCar has tended to neglect, and they just put on one of the most exciting races any of us can remember. One of the most exciting races in a long time. You and I were talking earlier. You said it was CART at Michigan 2000-esque when Michael Andretti and Juan Pablo Montoya went at it at the end, and it was a lot like that. It was great. So, you know, it's really touchy. Obviously, it's a little bit too close, but it sure was fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's very interesting that it's the first outside of the Indy 500, you know, and it's the only thing that we've had that's really closely resembled pack racing. You're not going to really get pack racing at Indianapolis with the way that banking and the track shape is. But I look at this and I think it's just kind of ironic, or you know, that it's the first real super speedway under Brian Barnhart. And I just got to think, what in the hell is he thinking right now?
Oh, gosh.
I couldn't even imagine. I mean, so many people, and you know, Will Powers over here saying stuff like, you know, somebody deserves to get fired. Gosh, we've seen him. I mean, he pushed a safety crew member today, which you should never probably do. But at the end of the day, I mean, hell, you're an athlete and you're frustrated. I get it. But I don't know necessarily. I think there needs to be a little bit of leniency. And you weren't on the air when we talked about it, but at the end of the day, I think that it would be nice if just for one day, everybody knows what IndyCar needs to fix. It's been well documented. They're learning. You know, it's about a blend of business and racing. I just wish for one day people could stop bitching and just enjoy the product that we saw for once. You know, if it's...
Well.
You know, if we're at a road course, it's too strong now. You know, they're not beating and banging off of each other. This isn't NASCAR, and it's never supposed to be anything closely resembling NASCAR. That's why I hate these butt bumpers that they got on there, rear pods or whatever you want to call it. I hate the way the car looks and everything else in between, and I could bitch all day about IndyCar and the things they do wrong, but this race was one of the best races I've ever watched, and it put the world on pause for 3.5 hours.
Yeah, and you may, you know, I know how you feel about the looks of the cars. I kind of like the looks of the cars, but it's precisely the aerodynamics of the cars that led to such a great race. And maybe the biggest takeaway that we're all overlooking is Honda won an oval race. Hondas were competitive on an oval race, and that was freaking wonderful to see. You know, there are a lot of people that are ecstatic and excited or pumped up about this race. There are some people who aren't so much. But I got to tell you, those folks at HPD have got to be, you know, jumping from the rafters and toasting themselves with champagne that they finally put something together that was legitimate, that was close to Chevrolet, that had the performance when they needed it, and it got them a win for a single car team, which I think a single car team had somewhat of an advantage in some aspects with the purity of the setup. It's all about what Graham likes, what works well with Graham and the engineers. You don't have four brilliant drivers like you have at Penske comparing notes all the time and sometimes getting it wrong. You've got one guy, do what works for him, and today it worked.
Yeah, absolutely. What are you thinking about this penalty? Do you think that there should have been a penalty on Graham? That's something that, I mean, we touched on a little bit, but ultimately, should there have been a, you know, a drive-through, back to the rear? I mean, what's going on?
I fully expected a penalty on Graham, and the fact that there wasn't, you know, it would have ruined his day. And when I saw it happen, I said, well, his day's ruined, his race is ruined. And even though it's not his fault, that's his pit crew. You win as a team, you lose as a team. And there absolutely should have been a penalty for that. You know, something like that can ruin your race alone. Great example, Felipe Massa, Singapore, 2008. And then he still got a penalty. So I think Graham got lucky with this one. I'm sure there have been a lot of discussions over at Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanigan, amidst the celebrations about that. But it was dangerous. And to me, that's unsafe release. It's just as unsafe as if you pull out in front of somebody or somebody cuts you off on their way into the pits. Fuel was spilling out that could have come off at any time. And when it did come off, it was right there on the racing line. They had to go to caution. So, yeah, I absolutely would have thrown a penalty for that.
I want to start with you, Adam, and I want to kind of go around to everybody. Did the right guy win today?
Ooh, you know, for Graham's perspective, from Bobby's perspective, from RLLs and HPDs, yes. But for, man, it's tough. For IndyCar, maybe not, simply because that should have been a penalty. And I don't know if there was a right winner today. I know you'll probably say Marco would have been an excellent winner. But the real winner is IndyCar, having a race that's stirring up this much passion, that's stirring up this much controversy, that's stirring up this much engagement. We have 80 lead changes. That's phenomenal. That is absolutely unheard of. And I enjoyed it.
That's
but as far as Graham being the right winner, oof, not quite.
Chris, how about you?
Well, as I said earlier, a lot of people in IndyCar have very short memories. If we remember right, Juan Pablo Montoya ran over in there, who was at the Indy 500. He was not issued a penalty during the race. In fact, it was a post-race infraction that gave him, I think, a small monetary fine of, like, what was it, $1,500? IndyCar's been very consistent when applying penalties post-race for pit infractions. Now, granted, they haven't had an unsafe release with pit equipment penalty this year, but if they didn't issue a penalty during the race for Montoya, then it would only be consistent for them not to enforce a penalty against Ray Hall in this race, given, you know, what happened with Montoya earlier this year. I think it's just them being consistent and applying the rules fairly to all drivers. The penalty that will probably be levied against Ray Hall is fuel will probably be fined a nominal four-figure amount, and they will probably put either the crewman or the team on probation for a couple of weeks, and then that'll be that. But there will be a penalty issued.
Josh, right before we get to you, we got a caller here. Caller, you're live on the air. I'm in the gravel trap. How you doing tonight? And like that, we just lost him. Josh, go ahead.
Yeah, well, Graham drove his butt off today, but, you know, I mean, the fairness, the penalty should not be blamed on Graham. You know, it shouldn't even be blamed on the fueler who screwed up. You know, it's, you know, the problem, it's an IndyCar problem. I mean, yes, we have this new penalty system where they review it in the week, but, you know, it's almost, like I said earlier, it's just a slap on the wrist. I hate seeing races that determined because of a penalty, and Graham likely wouldn't have won had he been given a drive-through penalty. But, you know, it's just, you know, it wasn't a grain rail problem. It was an IndyCar problem for not reacting on it. But yeah, as far as the right guy, Graham was amongst the leaders for much of the day. And, you know, he had a good race car and he came from the back to the front, and, you know, it was a win long overdue. And, you know, he's having a hell of a year and should be one to look forward to as the championship's finally starting to wind down.
Well, we lost that caller earlier, but we're going to try this one more time. They decided to call back. Caller, you're live on the air on In the Gravel Trap. You have a question or a thought on today's race?
Yeah, this is IndyCar Browns ND, and I thanks for allowing me to kind of contribute into this conversation. You know, I've been a long, long time IndyCar fan, and this race was crazy. It was amazing. It was everything you want it to be. And then you get I know you guys have talked about this already, but you get a sight on that crowd, and you think, what's the purpose if nobody's out there watching? And, you know, we were talking, I heard you guys talking a little bit about the Robin Miller message to Mark Miles, and how disappointing it would be to think that Graham Rahal, his purse for today would be $35,000 based on that crowd. Now, I don't know exactly how that is, because I know IndyCar doesn't publish the amount in purse. But, yeah, I sit there and I think, you know, this sport needs some sort of life to it. This sport needs some sort of breath of fresh air. And I don't know how you get that when you look around at 23 cars. Dale Coyne Racing has not had, outside of, you know, the Indy 500, sponsors at all. It blows my mind on how the sport's going to attract and keep sponsors for teams who are already struggling to do it, when an incredibly amazing race like it was today, we just don't see the crowds or the interest outside of us loyal folks. And so, just, I don't know, I guess I just wanted to express opinion to other like-minded IndyCar fans and my frustration that this series has so much to offer and can't attract anybody from a sponsorship or a corporate world for any length of time. And my fear is Fontana is not going to be on the schedule next year. And this race was tremendous. It was like when they used to race at Michigan, and they can't keep that race, despite the fact that it always produced, a great show. So anyway, interested in the show, and just wanted to give my 2 cents and enjoy it.
Let me ask you something real quick before you jump off here. You mentioned the racing today. Did you believe it was pack racing, or did you think it was just good tight racing and maybe a slight de-evolution of pack racing?
Yeah, what was interesting is the number of lines. You saw guys, Graham in particular, the guy's car was so dialed in that he could run the high line, the low line. People were just all over the place. And so despite the fact that they were close together, they were significantly offline from one another, that you didn't necessarily feel like an accident was going to cause the 10-car, 12-car pileup. So I think it was pseudo-pack racing, but I'm not entirely sure that we can classify that as pack racing. After a while, the tires kind of fell off a bit that would allow some of the spacing. But what was interesting to me was the fact that, number one, you didn't have the same kind of marbles that you had on other oval tracks, where it would reduce from 3 lanes down to 1.5. And then the other thing that really struck me was the fact that, you know, unlike in the Texas races over the last few years, once the tires went away, you would have discrepancies in lap times of about like 15 miles per hour. And you didn't seem to have that in this race. So I don't know if that's a tip of the hat to Firestone and the advances that they've made, or what kind of changes. But I don't know. It was exciting, and certainly I understand from a driver's perspective why they were afraid of it. But, I mean, from my perspective, I was on the edge of my seat the entire time. It was a great race. So.
That's fantastic. I love the fact that you're calling in, and we definitely appreciate that, and giving your thoughts and your feedback on the race. I want to touch on some of the points that you made, and that the tires, three of them were from Texas, all but the right front. The right front itself was actually a brand new tire that Firestone brought to California Auto Club Speedway to help with the lap times, the lack of tire fall off, if you will. You know, your thoughts on the pack racing, tight racing, what have you, couldn't be more true in my opinion. I completely support that. As far as your thoughts on the sport, I also couldn't agree more on that. The thing that scares me is we're touching an area where Formula One is having issues, and a lot of the issues we have are, unfortunately, paid drivers. And Dale Coyne is being run by paid drivers. Where's the long-term gain in that? I have no idea. I think it's just damage control, and you try to get lucky by making your fuel cell a little bit bigger and winning in Houston in 2014. But outside of that, I think that at some point, if I remember right, Josh is the one that talked about the leadership committee that actually does the purses. But if this was based off of what's going on with attendance, and that's what funds these drivers, it would be scary to think that a race winner just risked his life at 215 miles an hour for a $35,000 purse. That would be... Right, that right there is a kick in a place that I wouldn't want to be kicked. So, but you know, guys, Adam, you have any thoughts on his comments?
Absolutely. I loved your comments about the multiple lines and how it wasn't pack racing in regards to that. And that's, I think, one of the key issues and points on the day. So I appreciate that. And, you know, what you were just saying and what he was saying about the purse, you know, $5,000. And Agnew, I think, had the most damning comment on the day in that. He said, it's just not safe racing. We don't need to risk our lives for the 5,000 people here in the stands today. Oh, that was Tony that said that. So I can agree with that to a point, because we all know, you know, butts in the seats is what's going to secure the future of this series. But is it safe to say, oh, if there's 50,000 people in the stands, it is worth risking your life for? I mean, there's still everybody watching on television. And that goes all into IndyCar marketing. Verizon's putting good money into it, so they need to up that. And races like this are what's going to get more fans coming in. People like us talking about it, fans talking about it, people calling into shows like this, people telling their buddies at work, hey, did you see the IndyCar race in Fontana? And they're going to be like, oh, I didn't even know they went there, you know? So this is what builds into things like that. But that's a very good point. You know, 5,000 people is not sustainable, and that does worry me quite a lot.
Yeah, I guess my concern, my point is, I mean, these drivers, they're sustained, their lifeblood is off of whatever they bring on sponsorship dollars. And, I mean, how do you attract a sponsor, a large name corporate, you know, sponsorship that's going to sustain you for an entire season, if they look at TV ratings or if they're looking at race attendance? And that's what worries me, is that we're going to end up losing even the few large sponsors that we have based on attendance like this. Especially when, I mean, I don't care what anybody says, it's the most superior racing on the planet when you just look at all out. Styles of racing, the disciplines that it takes. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible. And I think one of the biggest victories or biggest winners for today was Honda engines. I mean, for the love of God, they were finally, you know, competitive in race conditions that weren't tainted by rain and pit strategy. It was just great to see them, which hopefully means that teams will continue to take a chance on them. So it worries me from the perspective that without sponsorship dollars, we don't have cars on the track for long. And I think I read some statistics somewhere that race teams are, you know, oftentimes one or two crashes away from just being completely out of the series. And I thought we almost saw that with Brian Herta Autosport last year with Mikhail Alosh, or not Alosh, Hawksworth, when Hawksworth got into the accident at Fontana. So, anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to butt back in, but I love the sport. I'm passionate about the sport, and for the love of God, I just want it to grow, and it just worries me when I see crowds like that. So, thanks, guys.
Thank you so much, and call in anytime. Thank you so much for listening, and you could not be more right about worrying about the crowd size and the sponsorship issues. And that is something that needs a lot more analysis. It needs a lot of smart people working very hard on it. And I do not think there are enough people talking about it or people working hard on it. So that's one of the things I like to do with this is raise awareness. So what do you guys think about this? Joey?
Well, first off, I'd like to thank at IndyCar Browns ND for calling in and joining us on the broadcast. Definitely some good points to be made. And, you know, I'm kind of wondering to the sponsorship worry and how the sponsors can come in. And, you know, right now even Target doesn't slap on. They went from two cars to one as far as fully backed sponsorship, and now Scott Dixon can't continue the Target car every single week. So even though teams like Scott Dixon's and even Elio with Shell Pennzoil, even though they can come in, and the reason they essentially stay with that team is because they know that they can win a title, look good on all the posters and all the glamour and all the glitz and whatnot and kick the hell out of everybody. But there's some real struggle. And I think at the end of the day, though, that the sponsors are partly to blame for not having sponsor activation and for not being able to, you know, I'm going into my local grocery store, and I see retired NFL linebacker Patrick Willis, formerly of the 49ers, on a Duracell display. And a retired football player is getting activation for Duracell. Where is that? It takes batteries for the radios that these teams use and this, that, and the other. And so, you know, to that point, I don't understand why we don't have more sponsorship activation. You know, Duracell was on a Ganassi car, so for the life of me, I'm not too sure why that is, but they've got to definitely do something to change this, or we're not going to have any fans in the stands, and before long, it's just going to be a quiet arena. But, you know, as it relates to everything else, I think that at some point, you've really got to take a hard look, and maybe this is I would love to give IndyCar the benefit of the doubt and call this a trial by fire year, because they really want the 100th to be a phenomenal, out-of-the-park phenomenon, and honestly, I applaud as much as I'm not the biggest fan of races ending on Labor Day weekend, and it hasn't been confirmed yet. If the race finale is Boston, and it's up there, as much as I'm not a fan of ending a race on a street course, I love the fact that they're going after the Northeast and trying to activate that market. I love the fact that we might see in the future there have been talks about going to Calgary. There's been talks about trying to host Laguna Seca and Sonoma, you know, within the same season, having different dates. So I love that these are actually thoughts that go on in IndyCar. I love the fact that this series has this series can paint its own canvas more than any other series in the world right now, because you've got junior level entries like Carlin coming in and doing what they need to do. You've got drivers coming in from all walks of life. Former Formula One drivers are messing about in Indy Lights. Junior level drivers like Sage Karam are coming up, and Gabby Chavez, and, you know, Matt Brabham. He's got the name. He's a hell of a talent. You got Spencer Pigot, also a hell of a talent. And these are all, with the exception of Gabby Chavez I just named, they're all American drivers. So there's some very good potential, but if you don't fulfill it, then, you know, it just absolutely doesn't matter. Adam?
Yeah, sorry about that. Phone restarted on me. But, yeah.
Nobody
was
phone. We didn't say anything.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, phone cut out on me, so I just had to call back in. But IndyCar right now, has so much momentum, and it's not just this race. It's been in the news, for better or worse, more this season than in a long time. Like you're saying, there's teams like Carlin, there's teams like 8-Star. There are people moving up. There's increased interest from Europe. There's increased interest here at home. There's good young American drivers. So there's no reason we can't address these crowd issues, these sponsorship issues. There are companies out there that are tailor-made for this that want the exposure that IndyCar can give them. And I think we can kind of fill that bridge and help raise that awareness and help raise that publicity. And something I take very seriously, because I think IndyCar can have a really, really bright future. I think it's more relevant than NASCAR. No offense to NASCAR, but you can't take a four-door family sedan and then turn it into a tube-framed, two-door V8 rear-wheel drive car that's not at all what it's intended to look like. You know, IndyCar is exciting. It was incredibly exciting today. When have you ever seen five wide racing in anything else? I don't think I ever have. So I'm encouraged by today. There are issues. You know, people will debate the safety aspect. Was it pack racing? Was it not? I don't think it was. And it'll be talked about a long time. And it'll be talked about by a lot of people within IndyCar, a lot of people within motorsports in general, and a lot of people in the general public. And that is really who we need to get the attention of. There are young kids out there who, you know, are probably watching a baseball game today. But if they'd turn that on, which is better than any baseball game I've ever seen, they'd become an instant IndyCar fan. That's who we need to go out and find right there.
Well said. Well, we got just a handful of minutes here left in the show, and had a little bit of time taken off for the call in, and definitely welcomed, because it definitely gave some insight on what a fan acknowledged today, what they enjoyed today. You know, Josh, I'll start with you, and then we'll go to Chris and Adam, just to get everybody's final thoughts on the day.
Well, all I gotta say is it was one of the craziest races of all time, and you know, it sucks that the crowd sucked, and you know, at this point, I think IndyCar can get it together if they think outside the box a bit. And you know, I hope the guy Fontana doesn't leave. I mean, not just my own sentimental reasons of being that was a track where I first saw IndyCar racing, where I covered my first race, and you know, and the staff of that track has been very helpful to me. But you know, outside of Indy, that track produces some of the best IndyCar racing when they get the setup right. So yeah, just my final thought is just we need to hope that IndyCar gets everything together. Would be race control, commercial side, fan attendance. They just got to get it together.
My turn.
Yep.
Well, I liked seeing the close competition today. Like I said, I would like to see a little more spaced out. Other than that, sure, the crowd wasn't as big as I'd like it to have been, but Fontana got screwed with a date. Can't wait to hopefully to come back next year, and it's a race in September or October that the season finale on Saturday night. It'll be even better. Looking forward to seeing Milwaukee and then Iowa.
I'll jump in on this one, and we talked a lot about the crowd here at the end. You know, if people weren't there, that's their loss. And I think there are going to be a lot of people in Southern California that are talking to their buddies, and they're going to say, hey, man, you should have been out there. The cheap ticket, it's a great race. You're talking about value for the money at a sporting event. Go to an IndyCar race. My gosh, the fan access is better than any other racing series, North American or otherwise. Right after the race, they're going to open up the garages. The fans are going to get to go down there. Might get an autograph, might get to talk to people. And nothing can get you closer than that. So it's an issue, but it's a solvable issue. You go back and look pre-split, and I hate talking about the split because everybody's talked it to death. And there were huge crowds at so many races. It's happened before. It can happen again, and I think it will happen again. Final thought on the day is I love that everybody's talking about IndyCar. I love that the race was so good that we all talked and said, we need to do a show tonight and talk about this. There's a momentum, there's an interest. And right after a bunch of other series have their major races, Le Mans, there's been so much talk about Le Mans and Porsche doing well. It's great that IndyCar can get its name back out there with people talking about it, because this race was on the level of anything else I've seen this season, or maybe ever, and I'm ridiculously happy about that.
My final thoughts are pretty much backing that of Adams. I'm very excited that IndyCar really honestly put on a show that, yes, it was it's racing, it's dangerous, it's meant to be dangerous, that's why it's racing. And, you know, overall, show of the year. I mean, that right there is race of the year, show of the year. It's got NASCAR beat. It's got everything that I've watched so far this year beat. You know, it absolutely phenomenal race. I mean, it could have arguably been the best race I've seen in the last 5 years, whenever I look back on it. Just the diversity, what it brought to the table. Honda looking like it was a David versus Goliath, because Marco was third, but surrounded by Chevys there in qualifying. And then as the race wore on, Honda kind of rose up and really challenged it. And it wasn't Ganassi and Penske. You know, their cars, yeah, they're around Marco's and they're around Graham's, but at the end of the day, you know, they didn't prevail. And I think that's also important to note is, you know, this is one for the little guy. It's not just the fact that it's Graham Rahal snapping a streak or Honda getting kicked around. This is a very underappreciated team, and they're doing it one car. They're not spreading themselves too thin with a lot of things. So hats off to Graham on snapping that streak. You know, I want to say I look forward to seeing James Hinchcliffe in the car whenever that happens. So get well soon, Hinch. I love seeing Ryan Briscoe in IndyCar, and it needs to happen on a permanent basis. He's definitely earned a ride for next year, a permanent ride for next year. You know, keep fighting, Michael. Forza Jules. I want to thank at IndyCar Browns ND for calling in and giving his thoughts. Definitely some good stuff there, and hopefully keep listening in and maybe get a chance to call in next week and give us some thoughts there. Love to have regulars on the show. And other than that, on behalf of Josh Farmer, Christopher DeHardy, Adam Tate, I am Joey Barnes. I want to thank you all for joining us on the Into Gravel Trap MAV TV 500 post-race show. That is an absolute mouthful. And, yeah, thank you all, and you all have a good night.